is a game for two. When three try to play, someone will get hurt.
Who is this woman anyway? What is she doing in my house?
An obsessive wife fixates on vengeance.
She's consumed with the idea that they're together.
I'd do anything for you, Ruth.
A lustful affair breeds a wicked plot.
He was worth 10 times his annual salary, dead. And he didn't even know it.
Now, where were we?
And a wealthy housewife keeps more than skeletons in her closet.
He's living in the closet in her bedroom, and her husband's down the hall.
For these deadly women, two is company, but three's a crowd. Nestled in the foothills of the Rockies, Helena is Montana's idyllic state capital.
The mountains are close. They're skiing, floating, fishing. It's a terrific place to live.
The perfect place to escape city life. Something Michelle Gable is desperate to do in 2008.
She suffered from, like, an environmental disease, if you will, and made her very sensitive to any type of chemical smell, chemical odor.
Modern living makes Michelle sick. She and husband Joe hope the mountain air can improve things.
You reek of gasoline.
But their relocation isn't quite the breath of fresh air they're counting on.
She complained more and more about these sensitivities. She would call up the police department, kind of ranting and raving about her neighbors causing problems.
Hey!
She, in fact, one day calls the police.
You're poisoning me!
Because they're outside cutting the lawn.
Hey!
And the fumes are bothering her.
Hey! What are you doing here?
Some people do have sensitivity to chemicals. But in Michelle's case, I think it was quite overblown. Michelle used her illness, sensitivity to the environment, as a manipulative tool to get what she wants.
Husband Joe has tried everything, but Michelle is never happy.
Michelle's problems seem to be expanding. Joe's at a loss. What is he going to do? It seems she's sensitive to not only chemicals, but everything.
Then, in 2009, Michelle becomes distraught when her mother dies. She returns to Maryland for the funeral and doesn't come home.
She stayed there for a full year, didn't ask Joe to come along. She just seemed to be kind of hiding in a house back there.
And Joe's back home wondering, what the hell's going on? But he decides, you know what? She's been acting a little nutty anyway, so why don't we just leave it be?
The separation stretches from 1 year into two. Joe finds a new partner, 50-year-old Sunday Bennett.
Sunday was described as a fun-loving person. Everybody around her really liked her. She had a certain sparkle about her.
And she is everything that Michelle wasn't. She's fun. She's exciting. She's happy. Chemical odors don't bother her. Joe's having the time of his life. Him and Sunday, match made in heaven.
Joe thinks his wife has moved on too. Not so. In September 2011, Michelle pays a surprise visit.
And she walks right into her old house. And Sunday's on the floor sleeping on an air mattress, and Joe's in another room.
Joe, I'm back. Who's that woman?
Joe spins a story.
Who is that woman?
She's just a friend, okay?
Michelle's unconvinced.
A friend.
She's still a little bit disturbed by this relationship, but they're not sleeping together.
Trying to calm the waters, Joe invites Michelle downstairs to meet his new friend.
Hey, why don't we all go out and get some breakfast and get to know each other?
She invites Sunday out to breakfast to talk to her.
No, sorry, I can't.
Sunday is like, who is this mad woman? I'm not going to breakfast with her. Is she crazy, out of her mind?
What are you two hiding? You don't want to be my friend? You don't want to go out with me?
I think it started to drive her crazy. There was another woman in Joe's life.
Who are you?
Michelle!
Who?
Michelle!
Why are you
Michelle! Get out! Now!
Michelle leaves, and she decides, I need to check into a motel, and I need to fix things now. It's been long enough. I'm gonna fix this relationship.
But Joe's not interested in mending fences. He's changing the locks.
I'm gonna have to go out soon.
Yeah, well, I have to get some of my stuff.
Michelle could not live with the truth that her husband didn't want her. Not that she wanted him either, but it looked bad for the princess to not have a prince on her arm.
After 2 years of neglecting her marriage, Michelle wants her old life back.
She wanted to hang on for the one thing she had, and that was Joe. She was not going to let some other woman take her husband.
Helena, Montana.
I'm your wife.
Michelle, you don't live here anymore.
After 2 years apart, Michelle Gable tries to patch things up with husband, Joe.
Please.
But he's locked her out and moved in new girlfriend, Sunday.
Now Michelle's consumed with Joe, and she's consumed with Sunday, and she's consumed with the idea that they're together.
Michelle starts stalking the couple. There's more than love at stake. Joe is her only source of income.
Michelle was not taking care of herself financially. She did nothing all day long, except think about herself.
Michelle was really keeping tabs on Sunday. She was following her movements, looking into her background, and essentially kind of creating this dark woman in her mind who was her enemy.
It becomes all too clear.
Who's that?
Who cares?
Joe never wants Michelle back.
Hi, Joe. This is Michelle. This is the third time that I've called you. Will you please call me?
Are you sure you told her it's over?
I keep telling her it is.
Joe went to a local judge and tried to get a restraining order to keep her out of the household.
The judge said, I don't see any personal danger to you or to Sunday.
At his wit's end, Joe files for divorce.
That's the tipping point. That pushes Michelle over the edge.
I'm nearly free.
Let's hope so.
On October 12th, 2011, Joe and Sunday settle in for the night. But they're not alone.
Michelle sneaked in and roamed around the house all night long while Joe and Sunday were sleeping.
Michelle finds Sunday's phone and decides to play a trick.
She texts Sunday's ex-husband as Sunday. Is this a woman whose mind is just becoming unraveled?
But Michelle isn't just here for pranks.
Michelle got her hands on a .38 revolver and a 9mm semi-automatic that Joe owned.
At 6 a.m., Joe awakes to his worst nightmare.
What are you doing here?
Why is she wandering through the house with two handguns? This woman is prepared to do damage. This woman is prepared to go to war.
I loved you and you treated me and for that woman.
Joe takes two bullets. Then, Michelle goes after Sunday, who tries to escape to the basement.
Sunday runs away from her attacker, Michelle. Sunday, at this point, has to be pleading for her life. Please don't kill me, please. But Michelle does what? She unloads another half a dozen rounds.
Critically wounded, Joe calls 911. The police arrive just after daybreak.
Joe has been able to crawl to the front of the house where he's still alive but bleeding.
Sir, can you speak? What happened?
My wife shot me.
But his wife is apparently also wounded, and she tells another story.
Sunday Bennett is the shooter. She's in the basement.
She says, Sunday's the shooter. She's down in the basement. So they back off. They don't know what the hell's going on now. They don't know who the shooter is.
Believing there's a shooter holed up in the basement, the police wait for backup.
Michelle must have known that Sunday was slowly dying in the house. And I'll bet she loved every minute of it.
When the police finally enter the basement an hour later, it's too late.
And unfortunately, Sunday died in the basement because nobody could get to her in time.
Joe's wounds prove fatal, too. The only survivor is Michelle, who miraculously escaped a hail of bullets with superficial scratches. Investigators don't believe Michelle's story, so she changes it, admitting she did shoot her husband, but she had no choice.
Michelle's claim was self-defense, that she'd shot Joe when he came running at her, and the same thing for Sunday Bennett.
The only thing really weak about Michelle was her excuse that she did it in self-defense. That is laughable.
Michelle pleads not guilty, claiming justifiable use of force. Let me ask you a question. What justifies murdering two people in their own home?
No one buys her story. In January 2013, Michelle Gable is found guilty on two counts of first-degree murder.
She got 100 years for each homicide consecutively, which is 200 years.
Housed in the Montana Women's Prison, Michelle won't be eligible for parole until she is 99.
she is in a place where she absolutely belongs.
Michelle Gable always believed her biggest threat was modern chemicals. It turned out to be something far more old-fashioned. Jealousy.
If Michelle Gable had put the energy into improving herself that she put into killing her husband and his girlfriend, she could have really made something out of her life.
Some women live a charmed life.
They were going out on the town, going out to restaurants, going out to the theater.
You're a cruel man, Albert.
But when the romance fades...
Once they got married, he basically just saw her as a housekeeper.
This house is a pigsty.
Malice can take its place.
She was motivated by greed and lust. And that never works out very well.
Manhattan, New York, 1914. 19-year-old clerk Ruth Brown dials a wrong number.
Yes?
Hello, this is Ruth Brown. I'd like to speak with Henry Pritchett, please.
I'm on a deadline and you're wasting my time.
And earns the wrath of 32-year-old Albert Snyder.
He chewed her out on the telephone, and then for some reason, maybe she had a sexy voice that he was attracted to, he called her back to apologize.
Hello, Ruth speaking.
Hello, Ruth. This is Albert Snyder, the cranky man that you just called.
Albert is immediately drawn to the vivacious teen. 13 years his junior.
I can apologize in person.
Okay.
She wasn't conventionally beautiful, but she apparently possessed a certain kind of intense sexual allure.
A smitten Albert pulls out all the stops, courting Ruth, wining and dining her.
They were going out on the town, going out to restaurants, going out to the theater.
He pursued her very, very energetically and finally, I guess, won her over one dinner by offering her a large, dazzling engagement ring.
It's beautiful.
Working class Ruth has hit the jackpot.
Albert was a successful businessman, and Ruth wanted a comfortable life.
There's just one fly in the ointment. An old flame.
He kept a picture of her in the bedroom that he shared with his wife.
Most wonderful woman I've ever known.
Jessie Gizzard, or JG, was Albert's fiance, but died before they could marry. He wears a pin of hers, bearing her initials, every day. Ruth decides she can live with JG's ghost. But when baby Lorraine arrives, Ruth finds the romance in her marriage fades.
When Albert was chasing Ruth, they went out, they had fun. He spent a lot of money on her, dining, dancing, shows. When they got married, that all stopped.
Well, there were two Albert Snyders. There was Albert Snyder, the suitor, and there was Albert Snyder, the husband.
This house is a pigsty.
Well, I'm busy taking care of our child.
Once they got married, he basically just saw her as a housekeeper.
Nothing was really right with the relationship. The age difference, the fact that he wanted to settle down and stay home, she wanted to go out and have a good time.
Ruth rebels and hits the town. And in 1925, meets her own JG.
Did you book a room?
Yeah, I got it.
34-year-old corset salesman, Judd Gray.
Judd was this model of incredible middle-class propriety with his big glasses and his very, very fastidious way of dress and his church going and his respectable life.
Buttoned up Judd already has a wife, child, and a white picket fence.
And apparently he was bored stiff.
Wild girl Ruth Snyder seems the perfect antidote.
I think it was for romance, sex, thrills, but then it turned into something else.
Ruth wishes her husband would disappear so she can be with Judd.
Things at home are getting worse.
If only there's a way to make the dream come true.
I need your help.
I'll do anything for you, Ruth.
Extramarital affairs can be just that, an affair. It can also be a motivation for murder.
Queens, New York, 1925. 32-year-old Ruth Snyder is doing some homework on Double Indemnity.
Good timing. I need you to sign your insurance papers.
It's an insurance policy that doubles the payout if her husband dies of unnatural causes.
Albert Snyder was worth 10 times his annual salary, dead. And he didn't even know it.
Is that it?
After 12 years in a loveless marriage, Ruth is ready to end it.
Ruth didn't want a divorce. She wanted to be a widow.
On March 20th, 1927, the Snyder family returns home from a rare night out together.
Snyder put the car away. He had been drinking very, very heavily at the party.
But there's another man in the Snyder house tonight. Ruth's secret lover, Judd.
You are going to do this, aren't you?
Ruth Snyder came down and said, okay, Judd, are you ready to do it?
I think I can.
But has this straight-laced corset salesman got what it takes to kill?
Judd went in and struck Albert on the head with this 5-pound lead weight. Albert awoke and began to struggle.
Albert might have seen his own wife watching this happen. I can't imagine anything worse.
This thing is going to be done properly or I am ruined.
Albert did not go quickly or quietly. He fought for his life.
Ruth douses her husband with chloroform, wraps his head in fabric, and his neck in picture wire.
Ruth had to take over and deliver the coup de grace to ensure that Albert was dead. They garroted him with a length of picture wire.
To complete Ruth's plan, the couple has some stage managing to do.
They went around the house just ripping things apart. Cushions were thrown around.
To pull off their hoax robbery, there's one finishing touch.
After the murder, Judd tied up Ruth. Ruth was quite the actress, but she wasn't a very smart one.
Ruth plans to be rescued in the morning by her daughter, Lorraine. But impatience gets the better of her.
Help, Lorraine! Lorraine, help!
She got tired of waiting to be discovered, so she woke up Lorraine and told Lorraine, I'm very sick, please go get help.
Go get mommy some help, okay?
Lorraine alerts neighbors who call the police. It's unlike any crime scene they've ever encountered.
One of the policemen evidently shook his head and said, you know, there's something funny. The police did not believe this was a burglary for 1 minute.
Take a photo of those drawers.
Ruth insists Albert's been killed in a home invasion and that her jewelry is missing.
It didn't take the police long to discover that the jewelry, which Ruth claimed had been stolen by these burglars, was actually located under the mattress of her bed where she had shoved it.
Investigators also find Albert's keepsake, his JG pin. But they don't realize it's from his long-dead lover. They think the mysterious JG could be the killer.
Then in examining Ruth's datebook, they found a reference to a man named Judd Gray. And they assume that the Judd Gray in the book was the person who had that JG stick pin.
You can have that back now.
When Ruth was being questioned by the police, she inadvertently gave herself away when one of the cops mentioned Judd's name.
Who is Judd Gray?
And she said, oh, has he confessed? Bye-bye, Ruth.
Friend, I don't know him that well.
In a twist of coincidence, the woman who haunted Ruth's marriage ultimately does her in.
That JG stick pin had nothing to do with Judd Gray. It had belonged to Albert Snyder's beloved dead fiancée that he wore next to his heart. But somehow it helped lead to the breaking of this crime.
Placed on trial for first-degree murder, Judd Gray is found guilty and sentenced to death. His lover, Ruth, is also found guilty, and she, too, receives the death penalty.
I think that she was the driving force. I think that she was the catalyst.
It appears to me that Ruth was going to kill Albert one way or another, but I don't think Judd would have ever killed if he hadn't fallen in love with Ruth.
In January 1928, Ruth's life of lust, greed, and coincidence comes to an end in the electric chair.
Ruth stood by and watched her husband brutally attacked and then joined in. Cold, heartless, deadly woman.
Some women want it all.
They were doing very well, and they could afford the lifestyle they had.
But too much of a good thing.
She once referred to her life as like being on Wisteria Lane.
Leads to trouble in paradise.
Love triangles can be dangerous and deadly.
I want him gone!
In the affluent enclave of Brentwood, Tennessee. Business is booming for Martha and Jeffrey Freeman.
I never thought we'd grow so fast.
Martha and Jeffrey had a company that would do background checks for apartment complexes, employment.
Good morning, Resi Facts.
It appeared that they were doing very well and they could afford the lifestyle they had.
Martha and her husband, Jeffrey, appear to be the perfect, happy, successful, middle-aged couple. They were envied.
For 44-year-old workaholic Jeffrey, this is a dream come true.
Jeffrey Freeman was a very nice, likable guy. I would describe his personality kind of like a teddy bear personality.
I'd rather be working from home.
But his 40-year-old wife, Martha, isn't satisfied with her nice husband and prosperous home. She's looking for more out of life.
Martha seemed to have issues, and nobody could find out, couldn't put a handle on what it was.
Martha turns to prescription drugs, thinking they might fill the void.
I don't know that she needed them all, but she took them to keep herself happy, I guess, during the day.
But the drugs can't cure a restless soul. So for some excitement, the couple goes for a night out on the town in Nashville.
Oh, amazing.
It's the 4th of July, 2004. Jeff has booked a room in a hotel for the night, but it doesn't turn out to be the party Martha is hoping for.
Let's stay longer. Let's keep partying.
Jeffrey didn't want to stay and decided he wanted to go back home.
You know, I'd love to, but...
He probably wanted to go home and get up early so he could go to church the next day.
Well, I don't.
Martha thought she already had the room. She was going to stay, and she was going to experience a celebration.
In her pursuit of excitement, Martha's about to do something reckless.
I don't know if she was having some type of midlife crisis.
Martha never indicated that she'd have done anything like this before.
Martha meets three Hispanic men and invites them up to her room.
Martha may have been a well-off married suburbanite, but she certainly didn't act like it the night of the 4th of July.
She had sexual relations with all three of these men.
One of the trio is 35-year-old Rafael Roca Perez.
He was from Mexico. He was here in the country illegally. He was a very large, sturdy guy.
In Rafael, Martha finds the excitement she's been longing for. She decides he's more than a one-night stand and dumps her husband for him.
Martha moved out of the house, moved into another local hotel, and had Rafael move in with her.
¿Cómo está?
¿Cómo está usted?
Rafael speaks no English, and Martha no Spanish. Yet for 6 months in the hotel, their relationship grows stronger.
Martha obtains somewhere some type of a machine, a device, that allowed them to communicate with each other.
But then Martha starts running out of conversation and cash.
Do you have any money?
She needs back the husband she dumped.
Please, just give me a moment.
What is there to talk about?
I just need to explain.
Jeffrey Freeman was a very forgiving person. I believe he loved Martha deeply. I believe he wanted their marriage to work.
Let me come home.
Jeffrey allows Martha back into their idyllic home. But the couple still don't share a marital bed.
She slept in a separate room. Jeffrey stayed in the master bedroom.
Martha? Why'd you lock the door?
I just got in the habit of living in the hotel.
For Martha, the sleeping arrangements are perfect.
I'm off to the office.
She returns with more than her belongings.
Now, where were we?
Martha moved Raphael in. She had him living in her closet in her bedroom.
Martha's behavior was, well, some would say crazy. Having a man live in your bedroom closet.
Martha feels she has the best of both worlds. A rich husband and a secret lover under the same roof. But how long can this last?
What did Martha and Raphael think was going to happen? He's living in the closet in her bedroom, and her husband's down the hall.
March 2005, in the upscale neighborhood of Brentwood, Tennessee. For over a month, Martha Freeman has a secret lover holed up in her closet.
How are you?
How do you know?
The closet had a pallet in it, a makeshift bed, food.
Husband Jeffrey sleeps in another room and doesn't suspect a thing.
Jeffrey was addicted to his job, and he spent most of the day, well into the evening, at work.
On the night of April 10th, Jeffrey hears a strange noise coming from Martha's room.
What the heck?
Hey, wake up!
No, Jeffrey, it's alive! It's okay!
Who is this?
It's just a friend!
He woke Martha and asked, why is there a man in the closet? And that there was an argument at that point.
No!
He told her, I'm going to go walk the dog. When I come back, he better be gone.
Now Martha has to choose her live-in lover of a few months or her forgiving husband of 10 years.
For all the years Martha and Jeffrey were married and what they accomplished in their life, in the end, it meant nothing to Martha. She wanted to do what she wanted to do, and that included getting rid of Jeffrey.
I'm in here.
Is he gone?
Yes.
Is he gone?
Yes. Get down on your knees.
Get down.
He used the butt of the shotgun to beat him with.
Give me the gun! Come back!
I believe it's her idea to put the plastic bag over his head to keep blood from getting on her house.
He was strangled with a large amount of telephone cord that we found with the body.
Martha wanted Jeffrey dead so she could have all the money, all the stuff.
Almost as shocking as the murder is what Martha wants next.
They celebrated by having sex in the living room.
With her husband's body nearby.
The fact that a woman had just participated in the murder of her husband and then had sexual relations shows such a cold black heart.
Martha's next desire is self-preservation. After betraying her husband, she now betrays her lover.
A man killed my husband.
Martha runs across the street to her neighbor, bangs on the door, and says, this man has killed my husband.
I know who killed my husband.
She names the culprit as her lover, Raphael. And the police find him hiding nearby. Martha says he murdered her husband alone while she was in the house.
Suspect in custody.
When we ask Martha why she didn't leave the home, make a call, or do something to assist Jeffrey, she said she just didn't have an answer for that.
There's something else that's strange. For someone who is supposed to be innocent, Martha knows a lot of detail of the murder.
In one breath, she's saying, I don't know what happened. But in the next breath, she's saying, well, I know this man murdered my husband. So how did she know that if she wasn't participating in it?
The cops wise up, and Martha soon joins her lover on trial for slaying her husband.
They were both charged with first-degree murder. Martha and Raphael both pleaded not guilty.
In September 2005, Raphael Roca Perez is found guilty of first-degree murder.
Raphael got a life sentence, which in Tennessee is 51 years before you meet the parole board.
Martha Freeman is also found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life. The woman who wanted excitement and got it with drugs, group sex, a secret lover, and murder pays a heavy price.
I'm in here.
Martha was not mentally ill. She didn't hear voices. She was not delusional. Martha liked risk. Love triangles can be dangerous and deadly.
Rather than divorce, these deadly women lashed out at those they'd once loved. Michelle Gable's marriage dissolved into malice. Ruth Snyder valued her husband more dead than alive. And Martha Freeman's search for excitement led her down a depraved path. These deadly women lived by the vindictive code. Three's a crowd. As Michelle's paranoia intensifies, Joe's patience is severely tested.
I think somebody's dumping something out there.
For Michelle, all the signs point to her not being heard, and the internalized feelings are, I don't matter.
There's nobody out there.
I'm invisible to everybody. Nobody sees me. Nobody cares what I think.
I'm going out anyway.
For over 5 hours, Michelle lies in wait at the bottom of the staircase.
What was she doing for 5 hours? I think she was thinking about what she wanted to do. Did she want to kill them? Yes. Should she kill them? Maybe not. And she was working up the courage.
While awaiting trial, Michelle starts up her usual complaints.
Michelle's defense attorney was trying to get her out of jail because Michelle was claiming that toxic chemicals in the jail were just driving her crazy. She couldn't sleep. She couldn't eat. She was having a horrible time. The bell wasn't lowered, so Michelle started taking things into her own hand.
Michelle tried to slit her wrists. When that didn't work, she supposedly jumped off a first-tier landing. It isn't known whether she was really trying to kill herself or simply get attention and get into the infirmary. Some women that kill their husbands do so because their whole life is their husband, and they can't stand the pain of being left behind. That wasn't what was going on with Michelle. Michelle was angry that she was being left behind.
Under arrest, the couple fall quickly out of love.
Once Ruth and Judd were in police custody, they turned on each other. She told the police she had nothing to do with it.
He claimed, that he had done this all at Ruth's behest.
The story of the manipulative mistress quickly becomes a tabloid sensation.
This was the case that really captured the imagination of the tabloid newspapers. This was the number one news story of 1927.
This was an era of great social turmoil and revolution when women were beginning to assert themselves sexually. Somehow Ruth Snyder became sort of the flesh and blood incarnation of the culture's fears about women gone wild and to some extent how to be severely punished for that.
I believe that their relationship was built on sexual gratification.
In Martha, Raphael finds his sugar mama.
She's given him money and a place to stay and all the sex that he wanted. And he was here illegally. He hit the jackpot with her.
They were trying to plan their next step at the crime. Whether it be to dismember the body was a possibility, or how to dispose the body. I don't think they could come up with any plausible idea on what to do.
8 hours after Jeffrey's murder, Martha buys them some time with a phone call.
Hi, it's Martha.
So at about 8:30, she called the business that they owned together and told the receptionist that he wasn't coming in that day. He was ill.
No, he's not well, the poor thing.
Martha Freeman was a very good actress.
You have a good day. Bye-bye.
For 4 months, Martha is free. Unaware that the police are gathering evidence against her. She even tries to collect Jeffrey's life insurance.
Luckily, the insurance company contacted Detective Corcoran to make sure that she was not involved in her husband's murder, and Detective Corcoran told them what was going on, and she did not get the money.